Hi, my name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Reverend Kathleen Green, who's the minister of the Unitarian Society in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Kathleen directs the board of the Metro New York District of the Unitarian Universalist Association, and she leads the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry of New Jersey, and there she heads the New Jersey Reproductive Justice Task Force. Kathleen is a strong advocate for marriage equality, immigration reform, and gun violence prevention. She's the treasurer of Ridgewood Interfaith Religious Leaders, and we're proud to say that Kathleen is a leader in our Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute. So, Kathleen, so thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Sally.
I'd like to ask my first question, focus it on your work as a clinic escort in New Jersey at reproductive health clinics. Can you paint a picture of what it is that you do? And then also just say a few words about why a woman going to a reproductive health clinic would need an escort in the first place.
Certainly. The picture is one in which volunteers arrive outside a clinic very early in the morning before the first patients arrive. And the escorts are mostly women, some men of varying ages and backgrounds and faith communities. And when we arrive and we gather together, we put on vests that actually identify us very clearly to those who are working at the clinic and to those who come to the clinic, that we are clinic volunteer escorts. And we position ourselves on the sidewalk, which is right outside the front of the clinic. Women come from both sides of the sidewalk and from across the street, and so we're all along as a very obvious presence that we are there as escorts. And women begin arriving shortly after we are in place. And our job is simply to help guide the patients and their companions who come with them to the front doors of the clinic. We are shielding them as best we can from protesters who have also arrived before the first patients are there. And there are protesters who are there harassing and intimidating women and their companions that come to the clinic. And so as we are guiding them to the doors, we are shielding them as best we can and simply distracting them from some of the horrible things that are being said in their direction and to them. So our main purpose is just to make sure that any woman who wishes to go into the clinic can do so safely and can do so with support. The women that we see that come to the clinic are not all, but I would say mostly, women of color. Many are from low-income households, and they come with their companions, who are boyfriends or husbands. We've seen women come with their mothers and their grandmothers, with sisters, with friends. So we are seeing quite a diversity of people who are coming to the clinic and choosing to come there for healthcare services. As far as why it's so important that escorts be there and be available, I should first tell you that when we approach a patient, we ask if indeed they would like for us to walk with them, because some are so intimidated by seeing large numbers of protesters on any given day that it's very intimidating and very frightening experience. So we offer to walk with them. And some women will say no, and some companions will say no. And oftentimes we find that with the few who do say no, as they begin to get closer to the protesters, or as the protesters actually get closer to them and come up to them, they change their mind about having our help. So we're always right there, and we're ready to jump in and walk with them, and again, try to do our best to make sure that they're able to just get to the door safely and feel as though that they are safe in getting there. And there are protesters, Sally, that are not aggressive. I want to make sure that I put that out there. There are protesters who are silent and who are simply there to stand with their signs of protest. there are protesters who are on the other side of the street, on the sidewalk, who simply are there to pray. And then there are protesters who are quiet, but they literally chase after patients. They will chase them to the door. They will chase them once they're leaving the clinic back to their cars. And in the chasing them, they are shoving pamphlets and rosaries and fetus models into the patients' faces. We have protesters that are filming patients. And then, of course, there are the very verbally aggressive protesters who stand on stepladders and, quite frankly, scream their ideology for hours on end. And they will scream horrendous things at patients, at companions, at some who work at the clinic, as well as at the escorts themselves. So there clearly is a need for people to feel safe and to feel as though they can enter the clinic without as much intimidation or harassment as they are receiving. And we are just simply a small piece of being able to provide that sense of safety for them.
I want to follow up on that. You're talking about being an escort and the protesters because, you know, as you know, there was a case that the Supreme Court heard in January that was about a state law in Massachusetts that required a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics in the state. And that followed the murder of a receptionist in Brookline at a Planned Parenthood clinic. So there was some real physical violence before that law passed. But when the Supreme Court heard the case, a lot of the press coverage that I read or heard about it depicted the protesters as these kind of kindly grandma types who were, you know, non-threatening, and their free speech was being stifled by this buffer zone. It sounds that your experience is a little bit different from that. So what's your response to that? And why do you do you think that there's a lack of awareness in terms of the public of who some of the protesters are?
Well, I know that Justice Scalia referred to protesters as sidewalk counselors.
And yes, he did.
quite frankly, I'm not sure what sidewalks he's been traveling on and how many clinics he has stood in front of for any length of time, but with very rare exceptions, that is not what I experience. It's not what I've experienced week after week after week outside the clinic in New Jersey. There are some who work at the clinic and certainly escorts that are continually harassed. But we don't engage and we're not fazed because it's not about us. It's really about safe access to healthcare for the patients who are there. And I would say, bar none, the escorts that are there have no problem with people feeling passionate about their convictions and about protesters exercising their freedom of speech. But no one has the right to harass and intimidate. And that is what the majority of the protesters at the clinic in New Jersey are doing. And it is hard to believe that in a state like New Jersey that, for all intents and purposes, appears to have easy access to health care for women and easy access to abortion, that we would have this situation going on. But indeed, we do. So there is certainly a lack of awareness on the part of many people just here in New Jersey that this is actually going on every week on the sidewalks outside of the clinics here. And yes, there are a few protesters that are not aggressive and that are simply there to exercise their right to be there and show the conviction of their own beliefs. But it's unfortunate that those are few and far between and that the majority are in no way doing counseling. And they are certainly not grandmas.
Well, and you know, we can contrast that with the buffer zones around polling places on election day when you go to vote. I think it's at like 120 feet for polling. So in other words, you can you know, set up your signs for your candidate. You can hand out leaflets, but you can't harass and intimidate voters right up to the door of when they go to vote. There is an understanding of that sort of safe zone for people to go to vote. And it sounds like, you know, reproductive health care, which is so much more intimate than that, there are not similar protections.
Right. That's true. And one of the other interesting things that I wanted to share with you when we talk about them being grandmas is what I have found most interesting and quite frankly surprising is that the majority, bar none, of the protesters are men.
I was just going to ask that. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that
yes,
is interesting.
Most of them, especially the most aggressive,
yeah,
those who stand on the stepladders and who are literally screaming are, for the most part, middle-aged men.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably not insignificant in some ways. I want to ask about a buffer zone law closer to you than Massachusetts in Englewood, which is a town near Ridgewood where you live. That town recently passed a buffer zone law, and it was 8 feet for protesters at city health facilities that included abortion clinics, and it was a unanimous vote. So can you talk a little bit about maybe what led to the law being passed and any involvement you had in advocacy efforts around that?
Yes. This came about after months of some very active reporting going on with regard to the activities of the protesters, constant reports of the activities that the protesters were engaging in, as well as film footage coming from the clinic. The clinic has cameras that capture some of what goes on outside directly in front of the doors. So the film footage, the reports, it wound up that escorts were actually being pushed, mm-hmm, and there were some little skirmishes that were happening as there was this rush for the doors because protesters before the buffer zone were allowed to really get right up close to the door and even scream into the open door. And Englewood residents were actually having to endure these screaming preachers and were not able to walk peacefully down that section of the sidewalk, which is in the downtown section of the town. They were not really able to do that in any kind of peaceful way. And so after enough noise was made about what was going on there, there was an ordinance put forth by the city council. There was debate at the council meeting. But the council, from the testimonies that they were giving and what they were sharing, it really was clear that the time had come for Englewood to put something in place to protect the women and the men who come to that clinic for their health care. And it was quite powerful to hear one of the council members talk about the tension that goes on. And the tension, he said, that was in the room there as we were there witnessing the hearing for this ordinance. There were protesters there, as well as those who were there to testify in favor of the ordinance. And to hear the councilman speak about the tension that was in that room and comparing what that must be like compared to the tension that would be on the street for any patient just trying to get into a clinic, it was something that really moved many of the people that were there at the hearing. And it was quite an experience to be there. We all donned our vests, all of the escorts that could come. We were there. We were involved in so far as gathering people to attend the council meeting in support of the ordinance. And we wore our vests and we simply sat together. We selected one person from our group to speak on behalf of the escorts, and mostly we wanted people from the town, from Englewood, to speak about what this was like, what was going on in their town. And then when the vote was taken and passed unanimously, nearly every escort and many of others in the room were literally crying.
Oh, wow.
We were so overjoyed and relieved that this had finally been done. And I can tell you, it has been in force for 3 weeks now, and it is definitely making a difference. Eight feet doesn't sound like a lot, but it is making a difference in what is happening with the patients and how they are feeling about being able to enter the clinic.
It sounds like a public safety issue, and it sounds like in Englewood, at least, when there was some public awareness raised in terms of film being taken, reporting, that opinions changed.
Yes, that is true. I think there were people, and we still have some people who will walk down, even with the buffer zone. We still have problems. You know, this is not a cure-all,
yeah,
because there are still aggressive protesters who are filming themselves, they're filming escorts, and often patients. They are still screaming, but at least they're not able to get up to the door. And
yeah,
we have residents who still walk by and will say to us just this last week, wow, I never knew this was going on.
Yeah.
So there are still people who are not aware, but once they become aware, they are more willing to speak out against it, and we will work towards getting now perhaps an ordinance that will stop the filming,
mm-hmm,
of patients and escorts.
Yeah. You're doing this work, this volunteer work and this advocacy work as a clergy person, and I want to ask about if there's anything unique about the voice that you bring to these issues, and I know that much of your work is interfaith. Can you talk, yes, about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I am a person of faith, and I'm a person who supports a woman's right to choose what's best for her and her family. And I don't believe that pro-faith and pro-choice are exclusive. As a faith leader, I bring a voice of compassion and trust to the work of reproductive justice, because for me, faith is about trust. And regardless of the faith community that you might come from, if you can look at faith as trust and reproductive justice being about a woman's right to choose to have children, to choose to not have children, and to raise her children in a safe environment, you can see that's deeply connected to faith or to trust. And to trust women to really make the decisions that they need to make. I do work in the interfaith community and am involved in various interfaith groups. Right now, what I am doing is trying to bring some awareness to the interfaith clergy groups that are in New Jersey to raise awareness of what is going on so that together we can work on some of these issues. Faith is something that belongs to all of us. It is not on one side of the aisle or the other. And to be able to see that and then to come together to work for reproductive justice can be very powerful, and I think will have quite an impact. I know my tradition as a Unitarian Universalist teaches the importance of affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of each of those women who come to the clinic. And it doesn't isolate, reproductive justice doesn't isolate or pit important social issues against each other. It really works to promote rights across a lot of areas, including eradication of violence against women and comprehensive sex education and discrimination based on race and sexual orientation, economic justice, environmental justice, and on and on. And this is something that I believe that faith leaders can rally around, because it is about much more than abortion. So if I can work to bring some awareness, then I think we can make a big difference in New Jersey and hopefully beyond that, working in interfaith groups.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, making those moral connections and connecting the justice part of reproductive justice to other justice issues is very important in faith communities. I want to ask about a sermon you preached a few weeks ago. You're a minister, and so you preach on Sundays, and you did. And this was it was in March, and it was around the time when the Supreme Court was hearing the arguments on the Hobby Lobby case, which was a arts and crafts store refusing to provide certain kinds of contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And it's basically an issue of religious liberty and private corporations and some other things as well. So why did you preach on that? And I'm also interested in how folks in the pews responded, if they, this was, you know, kind of a new issue to them, or you were, they were hearing it in a new way. But I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
Sure. Well, so I preached a sermon that was about reproductive justice, and certainly this case, I preached this Sunday before the case was going to be heard.
Okay.
So it was on March 23rd. I can remember the date because I knew the 25th.
25th,
And certainly this is tied in. This is a part of reproductive justice. So it was an issue that needed to be spoken about. And if we can't talk about it in our faith communities, then we're in trouble. We need to be able to talk about that. And it was important for me to bring awareness again, and this time to something that perhaps people weren't really aware was going on. Some people knew that, indeed, the Affordable Care Act contains this mandate that really guarantees there will be access to contraception. So being able to stand before people and to say, so any of you that are receiving health insurance from your employer should be guaranteed through the Affordable Care Act contraceptive coverage. You should be able to follow your own personal convictions regarding your family planning. And, of course, heads nod. Yes, of course, we agree on that. I'm preaching to the choir here. But then to bring up the fact that there are for-profit corporations, and there are more than just the two that were on that particular docket.
Oh, that's right.
But there are for-profit corporations that want to argue that that mandate threatens their religious liberty. And I was not afraid to call that out as being shameful.
Sure.
The issue is deeply disturbing to me as a faith leader, because these for-profit corporations are not houses of worship. They're not religiously affiliated institutions.
No.
And if they were, they would be exempted or they would be accommodated in the health care law. But they want to claim the rights and the privileges that belong to religious institutions. And because someone who started a corporation happens to hold particular religious convictions does not make that corporation a house of worship. It does not make it a religious institution.
Last time I checked, Hobby Lobby was selling crepe paper and glue. Last time I checked. Yeah.
That's right. And in fact, getting much of their inventory from China, which is a country they often like to talk about as being one that forces abortion.
Right.
So we can see some contradictions right there. Yes.
Yeah.
So some of this was, in fact, news to people who were there, to a number of people who really had only heard a little and weren't really quite sure what this was about.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who had even heard it, I wanted to drive another point home, and that was that if the Supreme Court were to decide in favor of these for-profit businesses, we are all going to be in some serious trouble. You know, that proverbial slippery slope is going to become so enormously dangerous when you consider the precedent that will set. And I think that was the point that at least for everyone then, even if they had heard or hadn't heard, that was something that they really took to heart and realized just how important this is and what's going on and the way that religious liberty is really being used and trying to be used as a tool to discriminate and as a tool for inequality, and that we have to stand up and we have to use our voices as people of faith and say this is not acceptable and we will not allow this to happen.
Great. Well, thank you for preaching that sermon, and you're absolutely right. It's the religious liberty of the employees and the people in the pews, as well as the religious liberty of the boss that counts
well.
So thanks for doing that. My last question for you just has to do with your participation and being a leader in our Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute. And just a few seconds ago, you were very eloquent in talking about, for you, what the connection is between faith and reproductive justice, and you connected it just really very beautifully. And so I guess what I would ask is, in terms of the public debate and the way these issues are framed, why do you think that connection is so important to articulate publicly?
The religious right has had a loud voice for a very long time and continues to have that voice. And that's fine. That is actually fine by me. I believe they should have a voice. The problem is that people of faith who don't fall on that side of the aisle have been quiet for too long and have not raised their voices. You know, my values are birthed from my faith, and my faith is my trust in the goodness that can come from humanity as compassionate and reasonable beings. My trust in my faith really lies in the strength and the power that human beings have to stay in the struggle, and the power and strength that human beings have to work together to create social change. And that social change is only going to be created when we use our voices and when we, too, have a loud voice about what are the values of our faith, and that we have a voice, we have something to say, and we need to be heard. The connection is undeniable, and the connection of faith to reproductive justice, for me, and I think for many people who would consider themselves to be progressive faith leaders or people of progressive faith, the connection is one of a deep commitment and a trust that oppression, that inequality, and that injustice can be and will be, if we're willing to stand up and speak out, it will be overcome. And that's the connection.
Thank you so much. That's absolutely right. And I like very much what you said about, you know, in a democracy, we all have a voice. And so what faith leaders like yourself who believe in reproductive justice and people of conscience, we just have to talk louder and we have to make our voices heard. And that's how change comes.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kathleen. This was wonderful. All your insights and your experience. And thank you for the work you do.
Oh, and thank you for the work that you are doing as well, Sally. I am grateful.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
You as well.